Good evening, and thank you for coming out on such a rainy evening and homecoming weekend. My name is Peter Berg. I'm head of Special Collections, and I'd like to welcome you to another evening of the Michigan Writers Series. We're delighted you can be here. I'd also like to thank Schuller's Books and Music for their generous support of the Michigan Writers Series. They also have provided books for sale up here, and afterwards, the writer, Robert Vandermolen, will be happy to sign them, I'm sure, if you'd like. It's my pleasure to have Robert Vandermolen here as our writer. I've known Bob for many years. He and I are both alumni of Michigan State University. I'm pleased that his papers are also in Special Collections as part of the Michigan Writers Collection. And so we're delighted that he's here tonight. I'm also delighted that Hank Meyer is here, who's a good friend of Robert's, who will introduce Robert Vandermolen to you this evening. Thank you.
Thank you, Peter. And it's a real privilege to say a few words to this group of readers and writers about Bob Vandermolen, who is one of America's premier poets, who also happens to be an MSU grad who lives up the road in Grand Rapids. Bob is the author of 9 books and 2 chapbooks, all of which I believe are on display downstairs in the Special Collections room. And much of his work has been published in the London Review of Books. I met Bob for the first time, about 25 years ago through our mutual friend, Dan Gerber. And Dan actually gave me this book long before I had the pleasure of meeting Bob. One of his early works, but notable chiefly for this wonderful captures his essence, I think. Bob is the youngest in a great line of MSU writers from the 60s and 70s, from Jim Harrison and Tom McGuane to Richard Ford and Dan Gerber, although he may be the only one who became an advertising major to avoid the language requirement, which we just learned tonight. We were walking over from Beggar's Banquet, and Bob said, this is just the right kind of night when I'd be smoking a Camel, walking out in the rain as the leaves are falling, and I think this is just the right kind of night to hear Bob Vandermolen. Bob?
Thanks. Thank you for coming out tonight, and thank you, Hank. I'm just going to read at random here tonight. I read some things from the Breath book. It's a poem entitled Bodies. I don't usually do introductions on poems, but it occurred to me I was going through some things this morning to bring down here for Special Collections, and I ran across a couple of books by Ken Lawless, The Fables, #1, The Fables, #2. And this poem really is a result of Ken calling me maybe 8 years ago. His son was murdered, and he was really upset and talked on the phone for a long time. So I basically took that idea and made it into something else. Anyway, bodies. This boy came into the library, said there was a body in the river. I just didn't fall off a turnip truck, she said, being originally from Saginaw or Bad Axe. One cold front following another week after week. The weatherman answers his door with a pistol stuck in the elastic of his jogging pants. I know a drunk when I sleep with one, she continued. He used to ski, too, until the cold got him. But he wasn't no suicide, not in his family. They liked to fight. The attorney removed his glasses. The older you get, the worse you look without money. On TV, a documentary pointed out that ancient columns were modeled on tree trunks. Maybe they ran out of large trees. I don't know, she said, every time you get one thing figured out. And this is a poem I wrote about the same time as the Bodies poem. I was reading a number of books, one winner by George Simeon, so I had to throw him into a poem. Someone looking remarkably like George Simeon in the shadow with pipe lit as the body of a young woman from a tenement off Franklin is hauled to the street, who'd had a bottle shoved in her and cracked off. under a hat like a newspaper man, say, in the 50s, notebook in hand, almost bemused, fascinated by what he'd be allowed to learn later, despite a whiff of anger, a breeze burning out an alley. Depredations less odious the further one retreated from the city, from the valley. A city map or two from orchard country, those apple-faced innocents content with ponds and ridges. Truth was, everyone from the coroner to the judge to the editor knew they had better secrets than anyone else, save the old industrialists. At poker, a phrase or two was worth mountains of detail, seasons of minutia, filing cabinets packed inside filing cabinets, hunger working for its own sake. A nod in the right direction kept Orchard stretching to the straits. I woke up with a cold yesterday, so you'll see me take my hanky out on occasion. I just hope I don't go into a coughing jag here. I'll read the next one, too, called Showtime. I haven't read these poems in a while. I was talking to somebody the other day about this. My grandmother was a secretary in the juvenile home in Grand Rapids, which was about a block from our house. And I was always told if I got in trouble, I'd be in the juvenile home. And I was talking to somebody the other day who grew up in the same neighborhood, and their parents told them the same thing. And it was close enough to our house so that I'd wander over and stand at the fence and watch them inside the fence, kind of like going to the zoo, really. Thinking, I really don't ever want to go in there. Anyway, Showtime. Showtime, says the dentist. He flicks on lights for the x-rays. I liked it better when they were more serious, or if when they joked it was closer to family humor. An uncle at Thanksgiving who lived in Europe when young. That polished scent of lumber boom wood up the middle of the white anvil building on the corner. A block past the newspaper offices, a Plymouth station wagon was suspended in a department store glass entrance. This modern enclosure, three stories high, I marveled. We were briskly out of the war years, though I didn't realize that that was what the excitement was about. Dad bought a similar station wagon, only it didn't have wooden panels on the sides. By the time I was 14, we had boards on the floors so our feet wouldn't fall through. The heater didn't work, and one warm spring day when the vent was opened, the car filled with bees. My doctor, a serene detective type, smoked cigars, never seemed discouraged by my illnesses. A burly man, humming to himself, he occupied a squat turn-of-the-century building at the edge of the red light district. There was an ex-boxer who let us sit on his porch. His daughter was a hooker. We pissed in his tub with him when the toilet was jammed. Or my dad and I throwing stones in the river we'd taken from a planter inside the bank, that sky pebbled with noon. My grandmother saying, as I sat down for lunch, at the juvenile home, boys don't have much choice in their education, but she worked there. I drove her when I was older. I also heard the tale that they screwed through the fence, separating the sexes. The girls backing up in a knot, their pants down to the metal diamonds of cross-hatching. My brother and I sat playing in sand under sassafras. You look up and watch a city bus crunching into a parked car, or boys hunted by men escaping into woodlots. Men once ran through the roads we were constructing, large flat footprints, police cars converging on a street of empty warehouses. Or when the president addressed the populace, faces without mouths, men in dark suits on top of buildings with rifles. Oh, I always like this one. I'll read both of them. The New Neighbors. I don't have to introduce something. The New Neighbors. He said, in 1966, we shot out all the streetlights between St. Ignace and Manistique with a .22 from Carey's convertible. There's not that many, I said. More than you think, said the partner from Howard, Howard, Smith, and Howard. Then, she said, I had this disagreement with the band, walked away in somewhere Pennsylvania, thought to myself, I ought to see New York. Grabbed a bus, and the same day, believe it or not, got a job as a singing waitress. Outside the sliding doors, the wind was popping with snow. We stopped by, said, to see what you were doing for New Year's. You remember Carrie Humphrey, said. He sold the script for that new movie. What the hell's it called? No, I said, I don't. But I never did anything illegal, she went on. I had a good time. It's odd how the years link up, though. This project, this invention, that idea, that gift. The sad, sour smell of memory, finally. What do you do now, my wife asked her. Transportation, she replied. I sell light trucks at O'Hara Dodge. Let's admit it, he said. Truth has become overworked. Illness, desolation, the dog dead. I much prefer these woods out back. All men are dicks, she said later, not to me, but my sister. This is a poem I wrote about the same time as the New Neighbors poem, A New Restaurant, which I believe was Sanchez when it first opened. I think I met Dan Gerber there. Then I came home and wrote this piece, A New Restaurant. I was teasing, but I do that all the time when I'm not alone, he said. About the threesome, I mean. My wife, another woman, and me. But, said his friend, in a threesome, isn't someone always a little neglected? No, no, you don't get the picture. I was at the next table, greasy snow on bricks of the street. These tall, wide windows pretending something on an empty street. It was not unpleasant. I could almost forget my difficulties and who I was supposed to meet. If I leaned back, I couldn't see the street at all, but shapes of older buildings at night the way their owners once conceived them. Truth is, I wish I lived upstairs. From another table, there was talk regarding Tiffany, who lost her finger in a door accident. Well, they might have been able to reattach it, but the chocolate lab ate it before they thought to pick up the piece. Someone named Tony shook his head. Someone named Frank asked the gliding waitress how old she was. Someone else made a wager. At the bar, a woman who looked like a lawyer said, when the pancreas goes out, it's painful. You last about a day, day and a half. I decided to order. I might come back to that. I'd like to read a few newer things. In fact, these two poems are in the current issue of the London Review of Books, and I've never read them out loud. The first one's entitled Toucans, the bird that lives in Central America. I'm constantly amazed the London Review people love my Midwestern poems. Anyway, toucans. Meanwhile, in Costa Rica, the volcano smokes. Toucans glide down to the banana plantation. For the moment, everything is relaxed. It is snowing in Michigan, but I'm thinking of the newspaper story in September, two parrots building a nest on a silo in Montcalm County. Guido points out a Lulu shadings above the coverts, assuming I'm a birder. I like their beaks, though I'm somewhat more interested in the volcano. Guido asks for another malt liquor. He needs, he says, to return to San Francisco for surgery. Turns out we know the same neighborhood and pubs. He talks of California girls, this swirl of old habits and parks, as in the feathering of dreams where everything's altered but names. The toucans are sometimes poisoned here. Guido touches the scar on his neck. Deb is kneeling, examining a beetle the size of her fist. The birds darken the horizon at dusk. In North Beach once, everything shifting beneath my boots, I stepped from the curb at dusk into a turmoil of gulls. Any other poem that's in this issue is titled Whispering, which in my mind is set in Saugatuck. There's a word in the first line that I don't think is terribly common. The word is susurration, and I ran across it in an English novel a few years ago, and I liked the sound so much I decided I had to use it sometime. It means a sort of whispering sound, which I define in the next line. Whispering. The susurration at night grows malicious, as it should. The marsh is now marinas. In that mixed light, gulls standing on pilings, soft maples where the streets end, gulls or ducks gliding, fish nipping the surface, the water moils. Everyone was once young and lonely as well, when hairstyles were different. Too many miles on them, the young woman remarks in the soda fountain off the short deck above water, insects spinning the hanging bulbs. He's not that old, says her friend. My point exactly, she replies. I got a bunch of stuff here. This is a poem entitled Sand. Water muscling to shore at twilight, muscling over her ribs, the water so warm for September. Thomas Paine said, "We just couldn't stay boys," regarding the colonists, or something to that effect. Ladybugs gather, covering a pair. Gulls screech about the deserted lighthouse. How agreeable to discover someone loves you, or even later, that you become a fixture in someone's stable of influences. You adjust your sunglasses and sip your Merlot. A robust season of potatoes and cod, when generosity was more than a glimmer of an inn's lights. All this time without a plan or reliable income. She drives like Barney Oldfield, says her dad, arm on my shoulder, approaching dust on the beach track. Just when I thought I was strongest and most personable. Here's sort of a companion poem called Cottage in the Country. With tristful care, stepping here, stepping there, how all the good measures leave the months as blank as detours. As bored as I was, spying from my room across the pasture to hers with binoculars. Her husband so aerodynamic, as we used to say, and she's so sensitive. I've been hoping instead for something like the Rococo nude or the woman standing at her basin. Short of work and short of ideas, omissible. Though I may have been projecting, as my sister implied. When what one sets out to do gets replaced, devolved among cicadas, stray peeps of hummingbirds, sand, dust in my boot prints, at night a porous rain that regrooms the country lane, the horse owners nodding into cell phones, an idling plane. She pulls at her bra straps, dried sweat and other imperfections. Disgusting, she tells herself. I turn away too, though my notes indicate otherwise. That reminds me, there was one I wanted to read in here too. Actually, a couple. If I can find it. Ah, here we go. This is the title poem, Breath. Your breath cutting a hole in the air, hawks circling, all day gathering firewood, until the sky is another face, one sensation bleeding into the moss of something else, rattle of beech leaves, silence of mud. With hips of another moment moving through this room, the open door. You rest against the door on a yellow kitchen chair. Wouldn't it be useful to be a wise man in old age rather than twitching like a bat in daylight? That coil around the sun, cattle at a friendly pace turning into a weathered wind, Right there, at some piling exposed, this faint abscess running up the knoll. There have always been antique dealers, we know. In Rome, they were particularly popular. Keep pulling the shroud on an ancient mummy until you end up where you don't want to be. Margie said, I hate that song. You've got to take her at her word. It's like working for the common good. At home with a breeze shopping through the willows, or in the country, leaning on a post left by loggers. Why cheapen yourself like a literary whore? Watching a leaf walk across the ground until you realize it's a mouse or shrew carrying the leaf on its back to fold down a tiny burrow along the path, reemerging to carry another. In the sky at night, major holes among the constellations. Summer of 94. Now, I can't really name a name here, but there's a person alluded to in the poem that I knew in college who became a politician that I knew at Michigan State. Summer of 94. My legs were sore from swimming. When I got up, Trish was already in the shower. I had a moment to feel old, that clap of a hand on my shoulder. We were reading the latest polls in an out-of-town paper. The waitress refilled our coffees. Are you voters? She asked. Yeah, I nodded. As she bobbed away, I realized she'd actually said boaters. Trish looked up. Why did you say that? How would she know, I said, but I was still thinking of an acquaintance who was running for governor. We were sitting outside on a fashionable deck above a marshy estuary. Swans and geese in the sun, boats of bass fishermen. Across the water, reeds had been removed, the muck hauled up, a marina jammed an entire Sunday morning. Pass the jelly, said Trish. That evening, we walked through the shopping district, a harmless town. Smell of the marsh and idling water. Main Street curved, slipped over the bridge. Occasional scent of the big lake dropping in and mingling. The beach wasn't many miles away. It's true, I said. I haven't seen him in 25 years. He's pudgier in the picture. He's one of the gang, though, I used to sell dope to a couple of times a week. You realize most of my poetry is fictional. Oh, I know. This is a chapbook that came out a few years ago when I was thinking the other day. Actually, I was thinking, I watched the debates the other night, and I thought I should read this poem. It's called Late Notes on the Revolution in regard to the American Revolution. It's broken up into parts with titles. So the first one is Voices. It was the weather begging the moment as we waited for General Washington to show with his little messages from Congress. Our fires prinkled the hill, prinkled our sleep, hearing voices right into sleep. 1781. Through the swamps and winter tangle, bloated streams went Nathan Green. Cornwallis grew paunchy as a grapefruit. Time waxes in the neck, a thick vein, fat deposits, lengthening of day. Something, too, regarding less solid alluvium. Prophets. The Dutch, mindful of trade, their kinsmen, barbs from the English, their memory of Spanish gold, their long fear of France, put a larger stake in their own heart than they could have been imagined. Supplying the Atlantic colonies with munitions and other materiel, they blinked at sea and lost flexibility. No one ended up feeling mawkish about them. Kinsmen. The ambiguity of a just cause, the importance of uniforms, depends greatly on a proper conclusion, who owns the paper in which the history is written. Sentiment in a war sways like algae. Who can stop it? Propaganda and Paul Revere galloped into destiny. Amidst the ardor of streets and caution, traitors and balled up political advancements, immigrants in for the juice of it. Calculated with words and ivy, family chronicles and such, dates on houses, profits, monuments. Overview. In London's Parliament, the opposition dressed in deerskins and raccoon caps. Adams grew disillusioned with Dutch democracy. There was too much of it. He felt ill likewise with plain-fronted debauchery. Franklin, on the other hand, in France, enjoyed the depravity missing in Philadelphia, the sophistication of wanton boredom. In England, they smirked off cue. In the real world, they said, it's different. Among the radicals in shipping and piracy, licenses to maim and scatter tacked to their masts. There were some who looked with longing on possessing the Maritimes, too, tossing biographies into the Bay of Fundy, seabirds swooping in for a view. Needs. Sails offshore from this hoary province of need, how to manufacture a worthy culture. Dimness of fog, cough of sea breath, haystacks shaped into loaves of rye. On a low neck of land, stragglers, refugees, inns where treachery could be bought with rum. Precision and dread, tombstones of marl, horses underfed. Outside the vacuum of power, things spun. It was difficult to stop the spinning. Jefferson, etc. Jefferson said, there's a beauty in reasonable stability. Washington said, yes, if we agree to stay out of foreign entanglements. Agrarian interests, Hamilton said, can be met best with proper money practices. Let's kick their butts all the way to Hong Kong, Paine said. Within a generation, Paine was forgotten. Politicians, however, were pummeling each other in the streets. Van Buren often dreamed of his youth, but no one knew that. I don't write very many political poems. I think that's more of a history poem, actually. Oh, I should read this. This poem entitled Snowy Evening, and I know a number of people who really didn't know what I was talking about. So basically, a number of years ago, I was painting a house for a gentleman who was an archaeologist at Grand Valley. I honestly can't remember his name, but he was an alcoholic, and he was married to a waitress who couldn't read, and she was a fairly simple woman, but looked nice in a cocktail dress. That's part of the poem, and I based it in Saugatuck. Oh, the other thing, there's a painting in the poem. Painter's name, I can't remember, but Dan Gerber's mother donated a number of the paintings by this painter to the Grand Rapids Art Museum, and I was wandering through one day looking at these paintings. So the painting is kind of a composite of several of this guy's paintings, who did mostly rural landscapes around Grand Rapids. Anyway, it's called A Snowy Evening. I didn't mean to sit in a bar with someone I barely knew, running my finger through watermarks like some sage historian with a brandy problem. An archaeologist I met once, well, that's beside the point. His theory died with him. The waitress who lived with him couldn't read. What seems so clear in retrospect, circling nigh like an osprey over meadows and hedges, the lost soft colors of youth, or friends grown estranged, particular towns gone touristy, odd ramparts rising up sides of a wind-blown bluff, not ruins in the traditional sense, you understand, but the mystery that clears itself up at the end of the book. I've always loved you, she said. Gulls fluttering that look like napkins, the hill opposite like a bear's back. As predictable outcomes deflate, fall into water like bark when no one but children are watching. What is scratched, discolored and small, so small you have to crouch close to the painting, an arrowhead perhaps among the chickens, flat pebbles, bearded men passing one of several painted gates. too much stuff here. Oh, this is a great one. I mean, I enjoy it. I mean, that's really nice to like your own work, you know. It's entitled The Fondness. You're drifting, she said, between reality and the pseudo-event. It's like a new cotton nightgown printed with songbirds, which one touches. It's as simple as that. Could-have-beens don't buy you a beer. The sash and sway of platitudes. No, he replied. I'm concerned with fondness. She made a deprecating gesture. How wisdom has abandoned the school system. How pleasantness has abandoned the borders of towns. She said, it's like busts and statues in the back corridor of the art museum. Suspended dust, pigeon shit bleeding over the windows, the red light of exit. You don't really feel that way, do you? He asked. I've had some misfortunes, she answered faintly, raised her finger and her voice. Disasters, actually. Before returning to her tea, she brushed both her earrings as if to see if they were still attached. But Jennifer, he pleaded. Her flat hand stopped him. Don't talk to me of fondness. Don't quote Rilke either. Another poem titled Waiting for Someone, which I really took the Cottage Bar downtown Grand Rapids as the setting for this. Waiting for Someone. On the bulkhead over the bar, names of steamers that used to stop here. The river silted with new islands and old tires. I've been postponing this drink for hours, she says, though I hadn't inquired. Across the alley where the train station once held court, exposed brick, hardwood floors, where I stood at the entrance, 5 years old, my hand in my mother's, red caps pushing carts, steam rising, throbbing train engines aiming north or south, hissing and blowing. Flurry of snow, so much authority among the businessmen, women in mink, conductors. Don't pay attention to Harold, she insists. He isn't tactful. He isn't anything. But I was studying the smoke-stained painting beyond the bottles and mirrors, a woman examining her shoulder for freckles or bruises in a perilous boredom. Once, years earlier, I had contemplated stealing it. Even monotony has molds, places where hair grows. I thought she might hit him with her glass, but Harold vanishes for cigarettes. An iron tint to the water just before freezing rain crosses the city pond with a crisp leaf or two. Feigning indifference, knowing where irony lay. Next thing, you're babbling like an escaped convict after a six-pack has gone down his gullet. Cabbages and snow, old ladies with dull stories, crested birds popping rotten red berries. But you get my drift. I can't recall if I was up north or not, or even married. Then a tall man pushing through the festooned door resembled my father when I hadn't had such a thought in weeks. Well, I'll go back to the breath book and see if I can find some more nuggets. Oh, this I like this one. The painting. Same sort of thing. I bought a book in a used bookstore years ago, and it was some art museum in the Netherlands. I can't remember the name of the art museum, but there were all these color prints of Dutch landscapes. And so I sort of blended them in my head and came out with this poem. The painting. Where a farmer switches a cow along a path to water, ships are moored a ways out. A prosperous time before detritus. Certain rules still intact involving partnerships and commerce and basic intelligence. One wouldn't say, hide, Martha, here come the damn potlickers. Or worse, as the decades deteriorated. Nobody had to hide. It was quite the opposite. No one even closed their curtains. and earthiness still extant kept Calvinists in check. It wasn't restricted to taverns and bawdy playwrights and insecure investors. That is, you got a free salted herring with your ale, or oysters, or smoked chubs. Drawing rooms were similar. The whole company guffawing, the burger's wife leaning over your shoulder. Landscape painters woke the next day, splashed their faces, ate their rusk, smiled at their children. Or how the sparrow waits until the sweeping is accomplished. All the porches swept, the conversations, salutations, the walk swept, then has no hesitation. Just as the cow's eye remains perfectly focused, but the farmer isn't. Or the hardy hedge, the squatting beach, a security of green, this mound to stand on, this terp, where something was once erected, rotted away. Whereas the ships float high, the sky is tranquil, the fish teem unseen and so forth. Reeds playing the bank, a broken tree branch, swish of a tail, cow pies in the leaning grasses, some cottage deep in the distance, a dab of blue and red, a marsh scent. Where we could go, you and I, mind our own business, drink all the chocolate we wanted. I could smoke a pipe at the end of the day, look out at the spires and rigging. You might, she said, be overreacting. Prints in a cheap art book, for God's sakes. Golden Age nonsense. These popping little holes of silence, you say. Crow's feet of silence is more like it. These towns where the gossip never quits. I don't care how deep in the marsh you live. I was thinking of this poem the other day. I was up in the UP a couple of weeks ago, and it's nice up there because it's there's no phone, there's no visitors. It's just silence all day long, basically. And your mind can wander into things you don't ordinarily think about or remember. Anyway, for some reason, I got thinking about this poem. And I didn't have this book with me either. Anyway, I'm glad I saw it again. This is Families. Who can forget the dried leaves skipping across the patio? Mother says, you were a difficult birth. Grandmother says the same about her, though the latter took place on a kitchen table. Outside, men smoked cigars, felt sick but didn't show it. One feels distanced by the black shoes of old women. But in photographs, the shoes looked good when the women were 20. All the trees were young, too, as they walked down a hard-baked lane. Only the men look odd, strangers mostly. Mother says, you can have all that stuff. We're going away. Grandmother says, yes, I was always a progressive. Then all the men died young. One shouldn't forget that everyone got cheated somehow. Mother's going to Palm Springs. Dad is going fishing. He was a difficult birth, too. Who can forget those long evenings drinking port, talking about grandfather? He was a real worker. He was a corker, says grandmother. Mother says, I hate spring. It reminds me of being poor. It reminds me of being old, says grandmother. But no one is paying attention now. I had to get married, she adds. One sits under the tree where picnics once were, beetles and sand fleas. All of them seated, complexions like peaches, the sun shaking through the cottonwoods, patterns of leaves snaking through sand, or the new wood siding of homes when cemeteries were what you had to cross in order to get into the country. Should I read one or more or what?
A few more.
All right. Summer of 74, I think. Hank was asking me this earlier tonight, but I worked for a circus one year, and I was a traveling tent circus in Canada, and I started in April, and I finally got back to Michigan in October. And I wrote a few poems about it, but it's tough to write circus poems that haven't been done before. Anyway, I worked as an advance man, so I did all the advertising. I was the one-man operation, hung all the posters, everything. Did the TV commercials and the radio things. And anyway, this is kind of a true story. It's called Night. The clown runs in. It's difficult to tell how much dope he'd smoked, but this is what he races for. In the little trailer ensconced in mud, we can hear the rain clearly enough. In Canada, all the talk is of winter in Florida. The clown transforms. He is hungry now. We all knew him in high school. The boss's wife has wild red hair. She likes us as we are. The elephant is pulling at its stake. There's gambling down the line where lights of the fairground are aging. In the next trailer, gin is being served. Do we go to town or not? And who drives? The boss's wife laughs like a virgin, causes the clown to stutter. Maybe his life was doomed from the start. Outside, we stand in mud, the heavens spiraling down with tiny shots of lead. You can smell the ocean, he says. We can't, but we don't care anyway. In the inn, he will surreptitiously eat all the guppies in the tank behind us. The boss's wife will grow more shapely. In Florida, no one thinks he's queer, he says. The locals will stare, amused. But he is in a mist now and can't believe in reason. The boss's wife holds his hand. None of us are hopeful. We say, Bay of Fundy, Prince Edward Island, Port of Basques. We don't want the son of a bitch to cry. He tries to keep from vomiting. To distract him, we open the door on the road home to hit a mile of mailboxes. We are impoverished, he says, but his nose is clean, is clear. We rock through the puddles. That's better, she says. So you get to know the people in the circus, and they're kind of a strange bunch. They live in their own little world, really. The poem's entitled The Focus. It's my one football poem. The Focus. So in the room, she unfastens herself from an $800 business suit, almost afraid I won't notice. I try not to, changing the channels from the bed until she closes the door to the bathroom, a faucet singing. And it's true, I'm reminded of football, though I live for the feints, the particles, the piling up of tendencies. Granted, I was seldom correct, anticipating, let's say, the end around. But the focus, a calmness in focus, on a mile of green while the stadium went berserk, I was the one chess piece that couldn't be trusted, which was the beauty of my position. Those white rollers of anticipation. Anyway, coached well or not, everyone else my size was eventually injured. This poem titled Brick. A few years ago, I painted the dementia ward at a nursing home north of Grand Rapids, and I'd never been around Alzheimer's patients before, and suddenly I was flung in with about 60 or 70 of them. And it was really fairly interesting. Anyway, this poem is based on that. The one I liked best called my paintbrush a feather. Heat rattling through the radiators, a whiff of soiled diapers, a map of the world I'm lifting from the wall. I want my red rooster, she says, licking her spoon. Let's eat our own shit, says her roommate, but neither is talking to anyone in particular. Wind skirts the alley with sparks of snow, the sound of backhoes digging to frozen pipe, gigantic horses' hoofs. They're coming to rescue us from this whorehouse, she says, rising from bed. I've grown strangely fond of the rungs and chutes of the Alzheimer's unit. "You have a dog's face," she said, says her roommate. "You are all dogs without hope." Across the brick street, an agent for the featherweight fighter, wiping up the last of his mushrooms and sauce, suggests that ticket sales have been proceeding nicely, his suit blending with the woodwork and plaques. My reddish ale in the mirror, an idling bus at the door. Steam vents and snow, blisters of snow and city ash. "Where is my baby?" she asked. "My baby can walk. My baby can walk." All right, this will be the last one. Accountability. I can't tell you how many times over, well, say 35 years or so, I've driven from, you know, Straits of Mackinac on Highway 2 out to Montana. I mean, back and forth all those years. So this is a poem kind of based on Highway 2. Accountability. In wet snow, tish tish of tail lights, 7 deer wandering single file up out of a gully. You decide to pull off, find a motel with an indoor pool, a bar, and cable TV. White birch, wild cherry, all day driving through the north, collapsing barns, those surprises in the blankness of glass. Sitting at dinner with sections of newspaper, studying the report. Bat dung festering in the heat in the attic caused the lodge to combust in August. Just about the time you think you have nothing else to say, bebop, French ticklers, the Korean War, playing poker with visitors from Georgia, ice fishing Carp Lake with students from Indiana, fussing with sleep, you hear a train stammering west, exiting miles off from a trestle into wheat country, into the steaming silence, those dreams of attending the big university. No one would know you. Always a new beginning. Places where cemeteries are larger than the towns. Hump of trees across the lake above the marsh. Mousy cupboards, bed springs on porches. Getting screwed without a kiss, explained the matriarch. The new casinos, feral dogs, the distress of families canoeing on a warmer day. Mist rising from culverts, ears of hares. Insects spanning the ripple of suds and sticks below, leaves cascading across Highway 2. All right, thank you. Oh, does anyone have any questions? I'm rather eager to go get a beer myself. Yeah. A long question, right?
You give us a lot of dialogue in your question. I just find that.
You know, I was just noticing that tonight.
Yeah. Can you just, are you aware of it, or can you talk about it?
I didn't realize I had that much until I was reading it tonight, actually. But I started out really wanting to be a fiction writer. And I just was never very good at plots. So I'm probably just writing fiction in my poetry. But it's funny with characters, you can get to say a lot, you know, a lot more things. I mean, if you have just one point of view, I mean, I think it's sort of interesting to have different voices coming in. It also gives me excuse to say a lot more things, you know. Yeah.
What is your earliest recollection of visiting a library as a child?
That's pretty early, I'm guessing. I'm guessing 4 or 5 years old. I mean, I remember distinctly going to the bookmobile. I think there was an age where they wouldn't let me take the bus downtown. In fact, I couldn't take the bus downtown, I think, until I was 6 years old. So I think I was going to the bookmobile before then. But yeah, I used to take the bus downtown and go to the library and get a pile of books every week. Yeah.
Were you writing at MSU?
Oh, yeah. I started writing in 10th grade, actually. in high school, which is probably one of the reasons I couldn't pass my foreign language requirement, because I started writing in the back of French class in the ninth grade, actually, now that I think about it. So I should have been paying more attention. But I always wanted to be a writer. Once I learned how to read, they thought I was dyslexic when I was 6 years old, because, I mean, you talk about going to the library, I would get books previous to that just with lots of illustrations and pictures. But I had trouble learning to read in the first grade, and I finally learned to read in the second grade, and it seemed so marvelous that I thought the best thing you could be is a writer to give other people this joy, you know. Yeah. Conscious of it?
Yeah. Who do you like to listen to as far as music?
You mean?
Questions, really.
Yeah. No, I am conscious of. When I was younger. When I first started writing, say in the back of French class in ninth grade, I was writing rhyme metered poems, and I didn't know any better, frankly. They didn't teach us much in school. So I just had my dad's old college textbook of these really terrible poems from the 1900s. And so I just copied those. But I just discovered the beats in the 10th grade and that whole shouting and ramming everything together. And so I did that for a while. And then, I discovered Ezra Pound and William Carlos Williams and started exploring, internal rhyming and just the sounds of words. And, you know, if you do that long enough, you do it without really thinking. All right?
Really beautiful line.
Oh, thank you. Well, I do really need a beer now. Thank you.